Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Natalie Andrews, Assistant Douglas County Public Defender, here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Tetron Perry. Your Honors, respectfully, this court should reverse the appellant's conviction. His arrest cannot be upheld based upon the traffic violations for which he committed, nor can it be upheld as valid under the Fourth Amendment for his mere proximity to the passenger, and it cannot be upheld for the faint odor of burnt marijuana within the vehicle. Now, with respect to the first issue as far as the traffic violations go, it is true that the court has previously determined that the subjective intent of law enforcement in an ordinary Fourth Amendment probable cause analysis is irrelevant. However, I beg the court to look at this case carefully and to determine that this is not the run-of-the-mind case, as the court put it in Wren versus United States. This doesn't call the court to do an ordinary Fourth Amendment analysis. Here, the arresting officer, Detective Brown, who is experienced in the Omaha Police Department, testified that both traffic violations that the appellant committed were non-arrestable citation-only offenses.
But he was wrong.
He was wrong.
Does that matter?
It does matter in this case, because if you take a look at the purpose of the exclusionary rule, it's to deter grossly negligent police misconduct. And here, that's exactly what occurred. There was no threat of officer safety with respect to the appellant. And I would argue that, in fact, there wasn't really any with respect to the passenger either. Detective Brown, who was on the driver's side of the vehicle where the appellant was located, testified at the suppression hearing that as the passenger lifted up his hand from down between the seat and the car door, that he told Officer Sundemeyer, who was on the passenger side of the car, dealing with the passenger, that he saw in the passenger's hand a twisted baggie. Then Officer Sundemeyer pulled the passenger out by his hand, opened it, and it revealed that there were drugs, a baggie of drugs, in the passenger's hand. Therefore, I do think it matters here, because then after taking the passenger out, determining there was no weapon in his hand, which was what arguably the state would normally be worried about or police would normally be worried about, there was no reason then to pull the driver out of the vehicle, the appellant, and arrest him and then thoroughly search his person, first going in his right front pocket and then to his coin pocket. The police did not have particularized probable cause to arrest the appellant at this point.
Well, the state will argue that there was a common enterprise involved here. What is your comment to that?
My response to that, Your Honor, is that the most persuasive case with respect to that issue, the proximity, is United States versus D. Ray. I realize the appellee cited Maryland versus Pringle for what it believes is the most persuasive case for this issue. However, I have to disagree. In the supplemental brief, the state argued that these cases are similar and that the driver was also cooperative in Pringle. But upon closer examination of the Pringle case, what the court was actually doing the analysis for with respect to probable cause to arrest was actually about the passenger. The entire case is about the passenger, not the driver. And the court found that a common enterprise could reasonably be inferred because upon finding the drugs and the cash, which were located in front of the passenger and within the passenger's reach, none of the occupants of the vehicle claimed ownership for the money or the cash. Here, I don't know how someone could be singled out more when the passenger was the one found with the drugs in his hand. Now, there was some discussion within the brief, since there's been a couple of round of briefs now, about drug dealing was mentioned briefly by the state. But there's no evidence of drug dealing here, and there's no evidence that these drugs were ever even out in front of the driver. All that the testimony supports and the evidence supports is that the passenger's hand was down by his side the entire time the police interacted with both passengers during the course of the traffic stop. I would also draw the court's attention to State versus Evans, which I mentioned in the reply brief. And it was mentioned in the reply brief for a different purpose, but I would also think that it is a good example, a helpful example, for how probable cause must be particularized with respect to an individual. Because in State versus Evans, this court said that there was no probable cause with respect to Evans, even though he was located within a car in which police suspected there was drug dealing going on in and out of the vehicle after they had conducted, I believe it was two controlled purchases, and they were watching the parking lot and watching the car within because they had no information about Evans. And I would argue that the same is true here, especially given that I believe this case is most like United States versus D. Ray. Especially so because Maryland versus Pringle, which the state relies upon, was decided almost 50 years after United States versus D. Ray. And what's interesting is in Pringle, the United States Supreme Court did not overturn D. Ray. They cited Wyoming versus Houghton, which had been decided a few years before Pringle, for the proposition that the passenger and the driver will often be engaged in a common enterprise. They did not say always, and they did not overrule D. Ray, in which they had information about two of the three occupants in the vehicle. D. Ray was the third, who they had no information about, and they said that there was not probable cause to arrest him, and therefore not probable cause to search his person once they got down to the station. And so that evidence that was found on D. Ray's person was excluded.
Does the amount of the drugs have anything to do with whether or not the arresting officer can then arrest and search the driver?
I would argue that, yes, Your Honor, probably it does, along with other circumstances. When you have a case like Maryland versus Pringle and there's just hundreds of dollars in cash found within the vehicle, along with drugs and several little plastic baggies, I think that's where there's a distinction. However, when you just have one baggie indicating personal use that's in the passenger's hand, completely out of sight from the driver, I think that's where there's a difference, especially when the driver was being cooperative, the appellant. He provided his identification. He told the officers that, oh, he didn't know that the taillight wasn't functioning. It was his girlfriend's vehicle. Whereas the passenger, who was interacting with Officer Sundermeyer, was being uncooperative, provided a false name. He was asked to lift up his arm. He did not do so, and that's when things escalated with respect to the passenger and then right after that with the appellant.
Counsel, could you address the smell of burnt marijuana, why that would not create a probable cause for the officer to arrest the defendant and then determine how much marijuana was actually involved to determine whether it was an infraction or whether it was a misdemeanor or a felony?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Since this court has last decided, or the Court of Appeals for that matter, the issue of whether the odor of marijuana is probable cause to arrest, the law has changed. It is now an infraction if it is personal use to possess marijuana less than an ounce. And of course, that changes whether it's necessarily an arrestable offense or not.
It still is potentially arrestable, even as an infraction, isn't it?
Potentially. However, here, what we have before us is no evidence of whether the police knew if this was the appellant's first offense, his second, his third, and of course, the...
Do you think they have to have that information before they have probable cause?
I do.
But
not always.
Do you have any authority for that?
Probable cause, before they have probable cause to arrest?
Do you know whether it was first or second or third offense?
Well...
If they smell the odor of burnt marijuana, what more do they have to have in order to have probable cause to arrest and investigate?
One could be evidence of drug dealing, but what I can tell you, Your Honor, that makes this case so unique is that there wasn't just testimony that it was the odor of marijuana or that it was strong. The officer testified it was a little faint, and it was the odor of burnt marijuana. Now, Detective Brown, who testified to this faint odor of burnt marijuana, also testified that as a detective in his 7 years of experience with the Omaha Police Department, that there is a very distinct smell between burnt marijuana and raw marijuana. And I would argue that when the odor is a little faint and burnt, it's at best indicative of an infraction, which Officer Brown testified even that it depends on how many offenses there have been, whether an individual can be arrested for that offense. So I'm not asking the court to make some giant leap in this case that probable cause is not established with the odor of marijuana always. It's just that here we're dealing with the little faint odor of burnt marijuana, and that cannot possibly be enough to establish probable cause to arrest an individual when, in light of how the law has changed in the state of Nebraska now that it's an infraction. And if I may just lastly, Your Honors, draw attention that the appellee in its supplemental brief argued that other courts have rejected the idea that the odor of burnt marijuana is less probative of criminal conduct than the odor of raw marijuana. However, if you take a closer examination of those three cases that the appellee cites, in the Michigan case, they were actually dealing with the very strong smell of marijuana that was described as overpowering, and it was unburned marijuana, raw marijuana. And in that state, Michigan, this amount of marijuana, even in personal use that we're dealing with here, is a misdemeanor. In New Jersey, the New Jersey case that the appellee cites,
I think you're out of time now, so let's conclude your argument.
And my last point, Your Honors, is that that New Jersey case, your license is actually forfeited for 2 years if you possess even a personal amount of marijuana. And the Alabama case cited by the appellee, it's also punishable by jail. And for those reasons, I do not find any of those cases persuasive for this court. With that, Your Honors, I respectfully request that you reverse the appellant's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. State may proceed. Good morning.
May it please the court, my name is Austin Relf. I represent the state of Nebraska. A bit of an unusual situation with this court's order for supplemental briefing as well as re-argument. In light of that, I thought I'd take a little bit different approach today and really focus on the points that were raised by the appellant in today's argument and then kind of open it up for questioning based on the sense of briefing as well as having argued the case before. I thought that might be the most beneficial approach. So, briefly, the state's general position is that this was filed as a search incident to arrest. Because the search and the arrest were contemporaneous, they were close in time, all that we need is probable cause before the arrest, or before the search or the arrest. And we have that on three grounds. Now, the appellant emphasized that the officer didn't realize that the traffic violations were an arrestable offense. The busted taillights, class 3 misdemeanor, occurred in his presence, it's arrestable. Officer was wrong. We don't think that that changes the analysis one bit. It's well established, Devin Beck v. Alford's the kind of seminal case from the U.S. Supreme Court, that the subjective state of mind of the officer does not matter except for the facts that he knows. Objective inquiry is a probable cause to arrest, and there was here, because busted taillights, class 3 misdemeanor, it's arrestable offense, he had probable cause to arrest, therefore the search was valid as an incident to that arrest.
Would you normally be searching somebody who had a broken taillight?
Would
that be normal police procedure?
I don't know. Probably not. But I guess maybe it's...
But you can consider other facts in this case, can't you?
Yes, you can.
I mean, don't those add to the basis for probable cause?
Well, sure. It's a totality of the circumstances test for probable cause, and all of these things together certainly... Since we assert that there are separate grounds, they obviously come together to form probable cause as well. But I think this court has said that the traffic violation alone is enough. That's State v. Sasson, same type of scenario where, well, not same, but a similar scenario in which the officer's arrest for drug paraphernalia.
Is speeding 1 mile an hour over the speed limit an arrestable offense?
No, but that's a traffic infraction. Statutes
aren't these infractions?
These are infractions. They're not traffic infractions. The statutes differentiate between the two. In fact, I believe it's section 29-427 provides the exception for arresting for an infraction versus a traffic infraction, which does not have that exception. So speeding, always a traffic infraction, not an arrestable offense. Infraction here, class 3 an infraction of, say, the marijuana possession would be an arrestable offense. But here we're dealing with a class 3 misdemeanor as far as the taillight violation. That is arrestable under the law. And the fact that it might not have been usually pursued in that manner, I don't think changes the fact that it provided probable cause to arrest. I guess a hypothetical might better serve to make my point. If the officer, all the same facts, busted taillight, turn signal, pulls him over, we have the incident with the passenger, suspected crack cocaine, odor of marijuana. If the officer then says, you know what, I think you might have drugs on you, Mr. Perry, the taillight, that's a misdemeanor, I'm going to arrest you for that, and he searches. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. The same result should occur here. The subjective state of mind is the only difference. The same objective conduct is there, the same objective facts shouldn't change the result. So in our view, again, under Devenpeck, under this court's case in State v. Sasson, taillight violation was an arrestable offense, provided probable cause, therefore justified the search as incident to arrest. As far as Your Honor's question about the common enterprise, we do think that Pringle controls. Very similar facts. I know that at one point the appellant said that, you know, the cooperation of the driver didn't really matter because they were focused on the passenger in that case, and that's true. The passenger was the one being prosecuted, but the U.S. Supreme Court said as to all of the occupants in the car, there's probable cause to arrest, and I think it's pretty clear from the case that the driver of the car was also arrested, and they said any or all three of the occupants, it could be inferable that they jointly possessed the cocaine and therefore probable cause to arrest any or all three of them.
Counsel, I understand that the trial court specifically in its order finding that there was probable cause to arrest talks about the driver being combative and uncooperative, and or in fact it was the passenger. When I review, does that make any difference?
No, in our initial brief, we acknowledged that the court was wrong in those facts. But the question here is a question of law. We acknowledge those facts, but now, based on those facts, it's a de novo review by this court. And I would also point out that the trial court, I think, reviewed or looked at its decision again in the bench trial and corrected those facts. So I don't see any issue there. I also wanted to point out in the Pringle case, I don't think that it's the quantity of drugs that matters. It's just that there is enough to infer a common enterprise. It's not necessarily a common business enterprise. I think it's key that the language of this common enterprise originated from the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Wyoming.
Well, what would be the evidence of a common enterprise if somebody had a joint on them? Of marijuana, what would be the common enterprise that would apply under those circumstances?
Well, I mean, with the joint of marijuana, it'd be basically shared possession. Maybe they're both smoking it. Maybe they both possess it. With the suspected crack cocaine, again, you can have joint possession of drugs. And I think the key is that...
But an amount might be significant.
I'm sorry, what was that?
The amount of drugs might be significant.
Well, it certainly could say that there's drug dealing or you know, if you've got... You know, 6 ounces of cocaine or something, that's obviously different than a gram. But I think that the emphasis on this common enterprise language comes from Wyoming v. Houghton, and that was just involving two syringes with a couple, you know, cc's of methamphetamine. They were not drug dealing quantities. It's just the idea that there's contraband in the car and that everybody knows about it, that infers a common enterprise. And I think that's what we have here when you've got a twisted baggie of suspected crack cocaine. He's got it out in the open. You know, he's between the seat and the car door. He's hiding it from the cops, not hiding it from the other people in the car. I think that's the reasonable inference to be drawn. So I think it's inferable to impute that possession possibly, at least for purposes of probable cause. Right. As far as another factual point that the appellant made regarding Pringle was that the money was in front of the passenger and the drugs were within arm's reach or within the reach of the passenger. And I think that's actually inaccurate. If you look at the Pringle opinion, the drugs were behind the backseat armrest and Pringle was the front seat passenger. So I don't think there's any question that they weren't, you know, within easy arm's reach at least. and yet they still inferred it to everybody in the car. State v. Evans, the appellant relied on that and a little bit differently in our argument today than in supplemental reply brief, but I don't think that controls. It obviously came before the Houghton case, came before the Pringle case. This court addressed it in Wichahaska, which I believe is how you pronounce it, I'm not sure. But and it obviously went with the Pringle framework and considered that controlling. It cited Evans, but went with the Pringle framework, and that's what we think controls here. Wanted to touch a little bit on the unburned versus burned marijuana. I stand by the cases I cited in my brief. I think that they emphasize that there's really no difference, that it still provides probable cause to arrest, whether burned or unburned. The differences she pointed out were in penalties or in misdemeanor versus infraction, not to the probative value of the marijuana odor itself. And then as far as the inevitable discovery, I guess I didn't really see any issue with raising that in the supplemental brief. This court's order requesting supplemental briefing didn't limit it. It just said we order supplemental briefing, including on these three issues, and then listed it. Tompkins, I think the case that she relies on is distinguishable. In that particular case, the holding rested on the fact that the state never raised it on appeal. The Court of Appeals did it on its own motion, that being the Leon good faith exception. And obviously, it's different here. We did raise it. They've had a chance to respond to it. There's no unfairness in asserting it now. And we offer it in support of the judgment. So unless there are any further questions, we submit that there was probable cause to arrest before the search. The search incident to arrest exception applied. We ask for support to affirm the judgment.
Before you sit down, counsel, you started out by saying you believe there is probable cause to arrest on three grounds.
Yes.
Was the first one the busted taillight,
yes,
the Class 3 misdemeanor. The second one is the common enterprise. And third is the burnt marijuana?
Yep.
All right, thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. I believe that concludes the arguments on that case, and the parties are excused. Next case is State versus Martinez versus Excel Corporation. Good morning. Is there anyone else?
I was hoping Mr. Martinez would be here. I brought an interpreter. This was my sister. Mm-hmm. On the Supreme Court release.
Okay. All right. You may proceed then. And for the record, Justice Castle is recused.